Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner. I'm a programmer at TIFF now, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Ken Wardrop, a documentary filmmaker whose features include His and Hers, Mom and Me, and Making the Grade, all thoughtful, empathetic human stories. His latest, So This Is Christmas, is a look at the preparations for the holidays in a small Irish village through the eyes of five people struggling to hold it together in tough times. A really moving social study, it makes its North American premiere in Toronto at the Hot Dogs Festival next Tuesday, April 30th, at 8:15 p.m. at the TIFF Lightbox. You should check it out. Ken picked Dr. Zhivago, David Lean's massive adaptation of the Boris Pasternak novel about World War I and the Russian Revolution, as it affects the lives of would-be lovers Yuri Zhivago and Lara Antipova. Starring Omar Sharif as Yuri and Julie Christie as Lara, with a supporting cast that includes Rod Steiger, Tom Courtenay, Rita Tushingham, and Alec Guinness, among thousands of others, it's a gargantuan undertaking that became a global smash, turning Maurice Jarre's Lara's theme into a hit single and earning nearly $250 million worldwide at the time, as well as winning 5 of the 10 Oscars for which it was nominated. I'm kind of surprised no one's picked it before, honestly. So thanks, Ken. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I chose Dr. Zhivago because it was one of those films that is a childhood memory and was inspiring. Now, looking back on it, it sort of had stayed with me. And I'm not a cinephile. I don't come from like a long history of love of cinema. And so cinema for me was sitting on the sofa with my parents on a Sunday, and invariably it would be a Western or a World War II movie that we'd be subjected to. And I think on one particular Sunday, my mum obviously got to choose the movie, and Dr. Zhivago was on, and myself and mum lasted 3 hours, 20 minutes or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And both really enjoyed the experience and probably cried. And it just stayed with me, this beautiful film. And, it was something that has come back to me over and over again over the years, and I do find myself returning to watch it. And I think that's a signal and a sign of a great movie that you will go back to it. Now, maybe it's not a great movie, but it brings back some wonderful memories of my, the living room and the TV and just us all being together and sharing in something.
It's fascinating that you'd say that. My wife, who's from the north of England, has memories of Bond movies with her family. That was hers. But it was all television, and there's no tradition in the same way. Like the Sundays were for movies at home. There's no tradition of going to the cinema as a family in the same way. In a lot of the smaller villages, and a lot of at least in the north of England, they had one. I've seen it, and it was glamorous and gorgeous, but it almost never played something the whole family could go to see.
Actually, I hadn't thought about that. We didn't. So I come from a small town in the middle of Ireland. You know, I'm a farmer's son. Mm. And so the movies to me were the TV. Like, actually, it was very, very rare that we would go to the cinema, and not as a family. It would be a friend's family would be going, and, you know, they'd ask me to tag along with their kids or something. You know, we didn't do it as a family, but that was because my father had very, you know, specific tastes. You know, he liked the Westerns and the cowboys, and he liked war movies. So to get my dad along to a movie would have been very odd scenario. but so to me, the movies were sitting down on a Sunday and watching it as a family. And every so often, dad would, you know, allow us to choose something we wanted. But again, we had only two channels back then. You know, so once you committed, that was it. You know, there was no other option, or you'd end up watching some cricket match or something on a channel. It's interesting. I don't think of the movies. I think of them on the small screen in that era. Obviously, then, as my first experience of the big screen proper was going to see, I moved to Dublin to go to school, and I was in sixth year. So I would have been 18, and my girlfriend and I needed some quiet space to be together, and we went to see a movie, and it was My Own Private Idaho, and here was a closeted gay guy with his girlfriend, and I was more interested in this wacky sort of movie that had these undertones, and I was like, what the hell is going on up there on the screen? And so that's actually my first memory of, like, certainly in as a teenager going to the cinemas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is the classic, this better not awaken anything inside of me narrative.
I know. Oh, gosh. I'm giving away too much here, Norm. I didn't know.
Well, I mean, it's all about your own personal experience, ultimately. But we can roll this back to Zhivago. I mean, is there... Because the film has this affected studio grandeur. I don't think it's a bad thing. But it's a level of, it's like this melodramatic patina that few other films of its scale bothered with, because they were so much more interested in big sweeping moments. And here's David Lean following Lawrence of Arabia with this massive Russian bestseller, this literary sensation, as I understand it, because Boris Pasternak was already this massive voice, and this is post-war, so the Russian literature thing was already exotic and spicy and different. And here's a story that is ultimately this grand romantic love story, tragedy, epic set against the Russian Revolution, but it's not treated like a scaled-up epic. It's all about the love story and the things that are... The rest of the world is an impediment, right? Like, it's about people transcending barriers. But that made me think, watching it again most recently, made me think of the way Douglas Sirk was taking things. And those are heavily queer-coded. And this isn't that at all, but it has something in common, right? Like, they're sort of speaking the same aesthetic language of grand emotions against grand events. And ever since I really watched Sirk's films and looked for the subtext as an adult rather than just watching pieces of them on television, I've always wondered if, you know, casting Omar Sharif as a Russian is some sort of other coding, because he's completely inappropriate to the part, but he's good.
It's a fair point. I mean, there's so many things that the film could be criticized, and having, you know, casting British actors and having them all have their own accents and not, you know, I get it, but it is bizarre when you're watching it. And then Omar Sharif being an Egyptian gentleman and, Judy Chrissy being a quintessential blonde, blue-eyed beauty. It's complicated in that sense. And I don't know where I'm taking this, because I think at the time when Zhivago came out, it was heavily criticized. I mean, and it was not liked by the critics at all. I think in fact, Lean had a bit of a meltdown afterwards. It was quite some time before he made another film, but I think he even contemplated retiring because of the reaction critics had for the film. But obviously it went on to do big things at the box office and became one of the all-time biggest selling. I think if you take into account inflation and all that, it's in the top 10, which is a great feat, in the same year as The Sound of Music. And so this was a hugely popular film, even though the critics didn't like it. And the critics took it apart for everything you just said, this kind of melodrama, this heightened sense of reality. I mean, it's counter to what the Russian movies would have been trying to achieve at the same time, where there was more of an authentic, people looking for a more realistic sense of cinema and what it could do. And here Lean came up with Doc Zhivago, which is essentially set on stages in Spain, you know, and it's just everything is heightened about it. But I think Lean himself said, and I may be wrong at this, but I believe he always wanted a sense of heightenedness to, certainly during this epic phase of his, not maybe his more intimate films of his earlier years. So I think it's true. And here is why a young little kid watching it with a kind of camp sensibility that's growing, and seeing Julie Christie, this beauty siren on screen, and something magical falling for this dark, sultry gentleman. I just went with all of that as a kid and just was taken away with it. So it is, in a way, very camp, even to the point where Victor, the baddie, is, you know, this bigger version of bold behavior of a man. And, you know, sit and I don't know, I'm just thinking of Geraldine Chaplin as she got off that train. There's a lot of trains, of course, in Dr. Shivago, but the early phase of it when they had the wealth and she gets off in this pink outfit and her pink fluffy Russian hat. It is quite camp, and it's interesting for you to draw parallels there.
Yeah, it just struck me this time through that the sense of composition and unreality they're not accidental. I mean, you don't go from Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia, which are two expansive, epic outdoor films, which are still about the interior of their characters. And Lawrence is one of my absolute favorite films because of the way that it negotiates that needle, that it is this incredible epic about someone discovering that he's a horrible person, and what it means to have been repressing his bloodlust, as well as, I mean, obviously there's all the sorts of stuff about Lawrence's sexuality that floats around in the movie. But the pivot then to this of something that is deliberately artificial, and the accent thing doesn't bother me because, you know, they're not really speaking English. I'm fine with that. If they'd tried to do Russian accents, I think it would have been even worse. But also, yeah, Sharif is struggling a little bit with some of the speeches seem challenging.
I hadn't noted this. So this is something I wouldn't have noticed myself. So Omar Sharif at this point would not have been a fluent English speaker, or?
No, I think he was fluent. I think there are a couple of really long speeches where it just feels like he's getting lost in them a little bit. And they're maybe I'm making this up in my own head, but it feels like they've been cut to preserve something of his performance. There aren't a lot of really long takes of him speaking. A lot of cutaways. It seemed noticeable to me.
Well, I mean, and Judy Christie doesn't say much either, let's face it.
No, she doesn't have to.
No.
She's so good at that. That just that thing of, you know, like, stand here and be radiant, and and in a moment you understand why she is this object for Zhivago, but also more to the point, like, she has her own personality, her own character. Laura's not just a mannequin.
I think, yeah, but I do think the side characters are more interesting in Dr. Zhivago, ultimately. You know, they are, you know, if you look at now I'm not very good with my Russian surnames, and so I'm going to get these wrong, but Victor Komarovsky and Pasha Antipov, and even his adopted father or his stepfather, Tanya's father, who there was kind of weird that they would be a stepbrother and sister and together. But even those gentlemen, put aside the female characters, those kind of are just seem a little bit more three-dimensional in a way. I mean, for me, Omar is the poet, and he smiles a lot through the adversity of scenarios he's faced with. And he puts on that gentle man's approach that, you know, I won't say anything. I'll stay on the fence across all of the kind of debates about the politics and all. So I think some of the other characters are more interesting ultimately. And Lara doesn't go, let's face it, she's pretty, what's the word, one-dimensional throughout. She's committed to this man, even though she is his mistress, and she stays, you know, she understands how much he loves Tanya. And so there's very little in the way of drama between them. That once they kind of, there's a lot of looking at each other and just a lot of unsaid, you know, I love you, but there's not real passion there. Yeah, I agree with some of the critics now that I've looked back on it and I've thought about it. I thought, oh gosh, you know, my 12-year-old self and my, you know, my older self would definitely kind of have issues with the film in that way. But it is an epic, isn't it? And there's nothing quite like an epic. Like, even the fact there's an intermission in it, it's just, you know, it just is such a feat of cinema, you know, that they would go out, they spent a year in production, they had no snow that year, apparently, in Spain. They had to do all of this. And like, this is incredible stuff. Like, to do it nowadays, it's just impossible. It's, you know, so it stands in that realm of films that just, you know, there's so few of them, but I'm thinking of those biggies like, well, obviously, Lawrence of Arabia or Ben-Hur or these kind of big productions, you know, that are part of cinema history. And that's, I think when you watch it, you realize that too.
Yeah, it's got the weight of that, like the roadshow expectation, the scale, everything. I mean, now that I'm at TIFF, we have this fascinating relationship to 70 millimeter films. We'll do a series every Christmas, Magnificent 70 mil, and we'll screen stuff that really does feel like time travel now. You're watching a movie that was produced 50 to 60 years ago at the start of this fad, which isn't a fad now. And it's like, now it's become an affectation, like vinyl, where Paul Thomas Anderson will insist that Universal or whatever strike a print of his movie in 70 millimeter, even if he shot it in 35, which I find absolutely fascinating. And he gets away with it, which is great. I mean, I love it. But the idea that it was perfectly normal to go to a movie theater and see a film on in a 70 millimeter print for a for an extra 50 cents. This was my experience when I was a teenager in the 80s. All the major, like Rocky IV played here in 70 millimeter. We got them all. We had a string of movie theaters in Toronto that could screen 70 and just did on the regular. The sense that this movie and The Sound of Music as well, that these were produced as events of their day, that this is after 10 years of these movies. Like, I think The Robe was 53 or 54. That was the first CinemaScope release. And ever since then, studios were sort of jockeying with each other to get the biggest pictures. Zhivago is the one where MGM stole Lean away from Columbia Pictures after he'd made Kwai and Lawrence for them, and they got him for this. And the expectations on it were that it would have to be one of the biggest movies ever made to bring the return on investment, to appeal to audiences, which is apparently why he went for the romance more than anything else, because that was something he hadn't tried before or hadn't tried since Brief Encounter. But that was the thing about the book that appealed to him, that he could tell another romantic story against this giant space of the war and still be the David Lean who made Brief Encounter 20 years earlier.
I didn't realize this. That's so interesting, because it was a Paolo Conti film, wasn't it? It was his...
He wanted it for Sophia Loren, yeah.
Yeah. And then he would have, I presume, brought David Lean on board, and then Lean and the producer, okay, said, we'll lean into to take on Pasternak's book would have been impossible. Like, they, you know, so they kind of obviously honed in on the love story and used. I didn't realize, though, that there could have been commercial things at play in that decision. Obviously, something with a love story goes bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it was how you get a studio to throw money at you to make this thing, but the expectation that the man who made it, the Best Picture winner of 1962, could deliver the scale, like to just get people coming back. It wasn't the Titanic of its day. I mean, that was Cleopatra, which turned out to be a massive bomb. Zhivago, because it came from the book, the bestseller, I think it had more of a footing to start with, and it wasn't perceived as a runaway production.
And it's interesting, the return on the money, I did read this somewhere, and it was somewhere in and around, again, accounting for the differences, but it was around 100 million to make, and it made 1.6 billion.
In adjusted dollars, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a huge return. And do movies do that anymore? Like, even the big ones?
The Marvel ones would have, right up until the pandemic. That was that was the kind of thing. And I guess, you know, you could do it.
With the profits, would they make that much profit on it? Like, those movies are costing presumably 400 million. Maybe
I guess I hear 200 gets thrown around a lot. So if you in the olden days of 2015, if you blew $150 million on a movie, it would make 800. That was fine. It wasn't actually, now that I'm saying that, I remember Warner releasing Batman v Superman and only making 800 million instead of the 1.2 they expected. And then announcing that as a result, they were going to claw back their mid-range production and focus more on blockbusters because that's an easier return on investment. Because even if you only make 800 million, you're still making 600 million profit, which will fund your studio for 6 weeks or something. I don't know. It's just preposterous.
It's crazy, isn't it? Oh my goodness. And here I'm, a little documentary filmmaker, like scrambling to get a few quid together to rent a camera that costs probably $5,000.
Yeah. But you're shooting in 35, which automatically makes you an archivist in your own way, right?
Well, yes, that's true. Well, this was a rare opportunity with the latest film that we did shoot on 35. I never thought I could afford it. And then the producer decided, you know what? Let's go for it. We'll skimp on other areas, but he loved, and in fairness, he was right. He just loves the limitations of it and the fact that you have to be really, really prepared and know what story you're telling. But it was scary. But having said that, we didn't have a studio system breathing down our neck to have returns. And, you know, so we're very fortunate here in Ireland to have wonderful support for the arts. And, you know, people will take a punt and understand that some of these things are important. So, the returns weren't at the top of the list of criteria.
Right. We have a similar setup in Canada, at least in English Canada. Quebec has a massive commercial structure that we simply never figured out in English Canada, because yeah, American movies are so close and people go to see them. But, you know, we're doing okay now. But yeah, state funding is absolutely crucial to any real development artistically. Otherwise, you're just chasing, you know, a remake of whatever was a hit 6 months ago, and you can never catch up or forge your own vision.
Yeah. I mean, well, we just can't compete. You know, you have to come up with an original version of that, you know, because it's just, yeah, we're in a different game, really.
Yeah, but you're leading the league this way, I think. Irish documentary, British documentary, there's something coming out of that part of the world right now that's, Canadian docs are there's very, very strong, but they tend to break along two or three specific, like there's the environmental documentary, there's the social documentary. But what I see in your film is the larger sense of everything pressing in on the people that you're talking to. It's there, it's floating, it's not forefront, but it's forefront of their mind. So your film doesn't even have to insist on it. It just keeps coming out naturally. Economic stresses, psychological stresses, just the general uncertainty that we're all in right now. And that, I have to assume, comes from a compassionate listener, right? Like, you have to know what you want, especially if you're shooting 35, and give people the space to reveal themselves to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes with, you know, we put a lot of work in the prep and to kind of understand the type of people we're looking for. And then, of course, you go out and you're not quite sure who you will find. But the one thing that's really important for me as a filmmaker is that I connect with them personally, and that we have a sort of we build a relationship before I go and film. And therefore, I think everything you've just described just comes out naturally, because it's like, it's two people sitting opposite each other, both sharing an experience. And I am aware of what I will need from our earlier conversations to explain the story and lead it in a particular way. But they also understand ultimately what I'm chasing too. But we do it in a really fluid way, and it can go anywhere, that conversation, in order to get to that point. And it's sort of, yeah, it's, what's the word? It's teamwork. And it's, and that's weird to say, because that person is a subject, and, you know, but they kind of know, I will have expressed what this film is and what I'm trying to achieve with it from the get go. And so they kind of understand. And I think in a moment it clicks when we're sitting down. And I always go, it's that moment that we lose the telephone voice, where, you know, I used to say, when my mom used to pick up and go, hello, it's, you know, and then if it's a friend, and it'll drop into, oh, thank God, it's you. I thought it was, you know, so, and I always think that's the moment where we both connect, and there's such a wonderful, freeing experience, because the person feels totally at ease and totally at comfort, and knows the camera's there, but actually doesn't give two hoots. That's what I'm always trying to achieve.
That's really well put. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, that's exactly what it is. When you're in the pocket of a conversation that, yeah, that's it. The telephone voice. I'm going to use that.
Well, my mother gave me that, because I was like always looking at her and, what? Who is this woman? And then it would drop. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, we were talking Dr. Zhivago, weren't we?
Hey, it's Norm, interrupting my own show to bring you up to speed on Shiny Things, my newsletter about physical media, culture, and the odd streaming project. Last week, I wrote about Paramount's new Blu-ray releases of Star Trek Lower Decks Season 4 and all four seasons of Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, two more streaming series preserved on disc, just in case. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at shiny-things.ghost.io or find a link at the Semcast Blue Sky account. You like reading about movies? I like writing about them. Come check it out.
Oh, I have a little anecdote about Dr. Zhivago, and probably one of the reasons it's stayed with me over the years. So when I was in first year in secondary school over here, so I was about 13, because I was a bit older than I should have been. But I was sitting in my computer class and our headmaster came in and said, boys and girls, I want to introduce you to an actress. Her name is Julie Christie. And we were all sitting there. And of course, I'm the only person in the class that actually knew who this lady was. And I was totally in awe. And she was in, they were making a film with Jeremy Irons in my old school. They were using it as a location on that particular day. And he got her to come and say hello to us. And it was just this wonderful moment of like, oh my God, that is a Hollywood starlet. And of course, I was the only one in the class that knew because she came and went and everybody was like, who's that? And I was like, she was in Dr. Zhivago. So honestly, she was the most, for me, she was in Dr. Zhivago. She was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen on screen. And it's down to the cinematography. I mean, every time they cut to her, they've like shaped her eyes. And it's like quite incredible how they can just like, and get away with it because it is so tacky. Even when like, even when they're riding on the, they were, it was the world, they were coming home from World War One on the, or maybe going, and even the light is falling and like, they must have been carrying like a light along on another like vehicle just to light her eyes because it was so unnatural. But yeah, it works beautifully.
Yeah, it is incredible how much the camera loves her. It's, I mean, everyone looks great in this film. Even like Rod Steiger looks chiseled in a couple of scenes and he's supposed to look dissolute and decrepit.
In his later scenes, he actually looks really dashing. And earlier, he looks kind of, I don't know what was going on there. Did they shoot in reverse?
I just think we're supposed to believe that war suits him, right? Like that this is his element, that he is at his best when he's able to unleash his worst self, which is a commentary that I think runs through most of Lean's films in that era. And also, you know, like you have Alec Guinness cast here as well, just showing up and being almost, I don't know why, I always think in my memory, I always picture Peter Cushing. He's playing Peter Cushing somehow, like that sort of rigidity and stoic presence.
Yeah, very stoic presence in this.
With hints of warmth.
I have to say, he's a bit of a weak link in this film for me too. I think, well, just because he looks so different than Marjorie, but Hop Brother is stretching it as well. But his role, I mean, it is quite, he plays a very important role, obviously, for the narrative. So that I think it's not his character. I think it's actually, Mr. Lean obviously liked Guinness very much. And apparently wanted Peter O'Toole to play Zhivago. So he was, you know, but I think he should have gone elsewhere for that particular role. Anyway, who am I to criticize Mr. Lean?
No. This is all valid. And in fact, what was it? I have the list of other people who were considered, which is absolutely fascinating. Max von Sydow for Zhivago.
Okay.
Paul Newman, which, yes, at the time I could see.
Yeah. He would have looked very good opposite Chris. Yes.
Michael Caine says he read for it, but suggested that he, well, according to Caine's autobiography, he read for the role but didn't take it. And after he saw his tests, he said, you should cast Sharif in this role. Sharif wanted to play, who was it?
Probably Pasha.
Yes, he did. He wanted the Courtney role, Pasha. And Caine suggested that Lean cast Sharif in the lead, which kind of makes, I mean, I don't know. There's all sorts of brownface at work in Lawrence, of course. And it was the style at the time. I mean, it's really difficult to explain to people that, I mean, in Zhivago, it's almost like a chance to make up for some of the brownface in Lawrence because he's casting a person of color in a white role here. and it's not commented upon, right? There's no attempt at whiteface. He's not lightened or anything. They didn't make him blonde. They just let Omar Sharif play this role, which I think is quite daring for a massive production like this in 1965.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you might explain, Omar Sharif, what had he done to this point? Because this is something I'm not aware of. Was he a star? Was he someone that could carry a movie? Like, had he had a moment?
Well, after Lawrence, he was a movie star. Before Lawrence, he was virtually unknown to Western audiences. He had worked in Egyptian cinema, yeah. But yeah, this was only 3 years later.
This is, of course. So Lawrence was, okay. So
his breakout.
It wasn't such a big gamble in that sense. Now, this is me being maybe ignorant of this, but I actually didn't perceive Omar Sharif as anything but white. And I see him as the Russian sort of look that is more Eastern. Mm. Do you know what I'm...
Sort of Georgian?
Yes, Georgian. That's exactly it. So I wasn't seeing it as an obvious... I don't think Lean would have done it like, oh, let's make up for... unless it was the 60s and there was criticism and...
I don't know. I don't know that there was.
Well, you might know more than me on that one, but...
Yeah, I don't... I mean, I'm not totally versed in the pre-production of Zhivago specifically and the decisions that were made, but certainly when Sharif wanted to play Pasha, there was no question about that. He would have been, he would have been cast if he hadn't taken the lead.
Okay.
Or hadn't been offered the lead.
Well, I'm so glad he took it over Michael Caine, because you could imagine that accent. I mean, we had some sort of strange West Country English accent from some of the soldiers and stuff. So you could have just imagined, Michael Caine has not been very good with accents in the past. So I can't imagine. He probably would have gone with his London thing.
Yeah, I would assume so. And also, good on him for knowing it wasn't right for him. Which, also, of course, it was 1964 and he had lots of stuff going on, and maybe taking the idea of taking a year off to make this film wouldn't have necessarily appealed.
And here, do you know why Sophia Loren didn't get it, considering she was married? Oh, do you?
I know. I've heard the story anyway, but which story? Oh, you don't
know? I don't know. I don't know. Because I'm wondering, if you're married to the producer, you would have thought you were a shoo-in.
Lean didn't want to cast her. His argument was she couldn't play the virgin, the first act of Lara. He didn't tell Ponty that, but apparently that was what he told literally everyone else, that audiences wouldn't buy her as a virgin beauty.
Oh, gosh.
And I guess right about that point in her career, she was certainly a little older.
Yeah, because Julie Christie is 18, 17 or something at the very start of this.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, which is sort of believable. One of the kind of, yeah. Okay, so Sophia, I thought maybe she was too tall or too elegant or something. I don't know.
The height might have been one of the excuses he gave Ponty, actually. Because that comes up too.
I did hear that. I heard somewhere that Jane Fonda had been considered at one stage, and that she was, and it was one of her great regrets in cinema that she hadn't got the role.
She probably could have played it. Yeah, she's on the list here along with Jean Moreau, Yvette Mimieux, and Sarah Miles.
Ah, Sarah Miles, of course, would have been,
all of whom did get considered at least, or maybe even read. And it turns out, according to this anyway, Julie Christie was cast on the recommendation of Jack Cardiff, the cinematographer.
Okay. Well, there you go. You live and learn. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Yes. I mean, these things are incredibly handy. I do have a whole bunch of books behind me that have these stories also. But now, of course, oh, it's horrible. Paul Schrader once told me that his greatest shame is that he will pull up a movie on iTunes if he wants to watch it for reference rather than get up and go to the other room to get the Blu-ray. This is where we all are now.
We are all in that space. Sorry. Yes, exactly. I have a shelf of DVDs here for the last 10 years. And I don't remember the last time I lifted one out for fear there's probably like a 2-inch piece of dust that'll hit me on the head. So So I understand. This is something I never get to talk to anyone about, is these kind of backstories to movies. But this again is part of the history of movies, isn't it? It's like,
oh yeah.
Here, like Judy Christie didn't get nominated for an Oscar and won it for Darling that year. And, and that The Sound of Music was the same year. And it's, to me, they are Christmas movies too. There are ones that we watch, you know, at Christmas. There's always, in Ireland anyway, I don't know about North America, but we always get subjected to The Sound of Music, Gone with the Wind, Dr. Zhivago. These are the ones that aren't the Christmas ones, but they kind of become Christmas ones.
Play at Christmas. Yeah. Well, it doesn't happen the same way in North America. In the spring, in the olden days, when I was a kid, Sound of Music and the Ten Commandments would be the two that always screened at Easter.
Ah, yes.
I suspect it started as a really cynical way to kill time because they're long. And some of them can be screened over two nights. I mean, I know in the UK they tend to screen the entire film uninterrupted, which is magical. But here you would get like the first act broken up with commercials and then the second act the next night.
Ah, interesting.
Which was just basically ABC at the time saying, we really don't care if anybody watches this. We're just going to, we know most people aren't home right now or they're not watching TV. It's a much more cynical kind of filling a hole kind of programming, whereas Kate has these fond memories of watching movies of a specific Christmas movie, which wasn't a Christmas movie, but always played at Christmas. So you make the association. It's the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. It was always Willy Wonka was another one. Oh, yeah. Mary Poppins.
Wizard of Oz?
Wizard of Oz, not so much. I can't remember that at Christmas. No. Wizard of Oz, no.
That was one I associate with Christmas here. And It's a Wonderful Life, of course, which only became a Christmas perennial because it was easy to program on TV stations, and they would run it at Christmas for a 3-hour slot.
Yes, yes. And we, of course, it is a quintessential Christmas movie now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. By the way, it just reminds me, when I did come up with this idea of making a Christmas documentary, my producer went, great, it can play every Christmas forevermore.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a brilliant idea. There are very few new Christmas classics, either musically or movies. Everybody keeps trying, which I find fascinating. And seeing the ones that endure, the ones that actually catch with an audience or with a moment, yours is a film that is, it's like an instructive Christmas documentary. It's deeply empathetic, and it also tells us that we're not alone in this cloud, this fog. My in-laws are facing their first Christmas without their parents this year, and I think it's going to land very, very differently.
That's a really, you know, I think, to be honest, Norm, that's one of the purposes behind the film, was to ensure people know we're in it together, that we're not, you know, just realize if you're having a shitty one, there are plenty more. You know, you just can go next door and knock on your neighbor and there will be another version. You know, I think that's the sad thing about Christmas is, you know, we're just so subjected to the jolliness and the color and we just all assume that's the reality, but it's far from it. You know, any problem or any struggle that you're facing is just accentuated and further complicated at Christmas time because of all the expectations and all the, you know, the noise around it.
Yeah. I mean, even the most pastoral and perfect looking Christmases are portrayed in, you know, in popular fiction as this terrifying race to get to perfection. Which you get your happy ending that way, but you're in this horrible squirming state of anxiety for the first 100 minutes of any of these stories. And I'm amazed how that's overlooked. Like everybody, I suppose it's the way the body represses trauma. When you don't remember the pain of an injury, you just remember the time it took to heal, something like that. But with Christmas, the depression, it seems to be pretty cyclical, and no one wants to acknowledge it, that it happens every year, that everyone has to live up to this expectation of perfection that, you know, that is impossible to attain unless you have a great deal of money and a great deal of time. And
yeah. Or you can escape it. You know, and I have done on two occasions just disappeared. Mm. Yeah. My mom. So sorry, I know we digress again, but just it's because. Okay. Yeah, but I'll go back to, you know, why that, you know, one of the things that inspired this film was I lost my grandmother, who was living with us, died on Christmas Day. Oh. And when I was 11. And yeah, so a big, you know, a big event in our lives and something that you don't forget. And she was incredibly close to my mom. They were very, you know, very, very close. So thereafter, Christmas became, you know, a time of year that my mom dreaded because it was just this soaked with this memory. And yeah, so thereafter, it just was a bleak time. And you know, my father wasn't one for trying to make it anything but, and my mom would like hide the fact that she was crying into the, you know, there was this position in that she would adopt over, you know, when she was making Christmas dinner and the turkey and everybody was like, oh, you know, and invariably my mom's head would just lean on the top of the cooker. It had this thing and I would see her crying and then it would be like just this sad sort of bleakness that would descend. And yeah, and I was like looking for ideas for a film, and I thought, you know what, Christmas, I'd just like to share something about Christmases and make sure that people just understand that, you know, we can do it together and that it's about having time with people and just cherishing that more than anything else.
Yeah, well, the thing I keep coming back to is that it's not unlike, this obviously is my own bias, but it's not unlike going to see a movie in a theater, right? Like everybody in that room is having a different emotional experience and coming from a different place, but you all get to sit and experience the same thing. You'll process it differently. You'll interpret it differently, but the picture and sound don't change, right? Like you're all in this thing together and it bonds you the at least for the running time, the experience of applauding or crying or laughing. Live performance isn't the same. I find it absolutely fascinating. We all surrender to this dream state together and whatever happens, happens. And you've made a movie that says it's okay to surrender to the dream state, right? Like the film is about welcoming you into it, into itself, and bringing you out with a deeper understanding of literally of the people around you, which, you know, I'm trying in my way to sort of staple it back to the experience of seeing Zhivago in 65 and having the orchestra start, like the entr'acte starts up and people are pulled into it in a different way. But that hasn't changed. I mean, the way we see movies is changing radically, but just the fact that you shot this on 35 and that it is a film and it's designed to be seen by a people, by multiple people at once, really does feel like you're reaching back to a different type of tradition, where the modern version of the tradition that you've made the movie about is ambivalence and despair.
Mm. Okay, that's it. Really interesting. I would not have been able to. Well done, Norm. Together, I was like that. Yeah. Well, when you think about the going to see a movie and the shared experience and what we project onto that. As you say, it's the exact same image, same sound that you're experiencing. I had this, I think, just recently seeing a movie with a friend, and we both got up and I looked at her and she went, I loved it. I went, I hated it. I thought you know, and I just assumed she was having the same experience as I was having. And it's like, it's quite extraordinary that you can be, you know, share. And in a way, Christmas is like that. It's like, you know, it is something that we all have a version of it. And yeah, it's a shared experience. I don't know. I think, Norm, you've hit the nail on the head there with how to link the two of them together. But yet it's a quandary for me to kind of
ponder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is what I do, right? I mean, I work at a movie theater basically now, so I have to sort of pull it all back to the idea of the cinematic experience and the communal experience of cinema specifically. Mm-hmm. But there is something to it. I think there is something that doesn't change no matter how much the technology changes and whatever is available for streaming. People still want to sit in the dark together and see this thing and feel this thing. And you know, as long as we have film festivals, I think there's even more excitement about that because you may never get the chance to see this particular film again.
Yeah. Well, I hope it continues. Obviously, we experienced with COVID when we all lost that. And I just thought everybody would rush back to it because it's so magical. And it took a long time for that, for people. And I think we're having to re-educate ourselves and to kind of not, what's the word? I think we've just got lazy about it and about experiences since COVID. And I would be someone that has my cinema going has dropped For sure, I've not been going to the cinema as often, and I find myself, which I hadn't been doing, is choosing to watch something on the player or on the streamers as opposed to going to cinema. And actually, I've started to really check myself and saying, no, get on your bike, go out, experience it. And then you go into the cinema and it is, as you say, this different experience, sitting down up beside someone and hearing someone laugh in the movie theater, and you're like, what are they laughing at? And you're trying to dissect what they got out of this and what I'm not getting, or vice versa. And it is just different, isn't it? And I think it's lovely to hear you comment on the 35 aspect, which obviously, you know, Zhivago and all the older films have, but it's one of the reasons why I shot on 35 too, is to differentiate it, that it could, there was something about this that could feel a little bit different. And I hope some people pick it up, not everybody, but every so often someone says something to me about it, just felt a little bit different. And I'm like, that'll be the 35.
Yeah, well, and it also looks like a Christmas movie, right? Like, it, the imagery looks like we expect it to look. Trees and lights and Santa suits and all of that, because that's how we've been, that's how we've received it over the decades on film. That's where we get our images from, where we get this other collective memory of what Christmas is supposed to be. So, it felt to me like this is, I just thought it was an ingenious decision because it frames things. It gives you the instant connection to what a Christmas is supposed to, quote, in finger quotes, look like.
Yeah, that's another good point. The texture of Christmas is quite specific, and a lot of our memories around Christmas are those kind of the older kind of versions of Christmas, even though, you know, we all know it's gone a little bit more glitter and plastic. We still harp back. I mean, even when you look at the merchandising, they're all trying to imitate the older school stuff. So, that's a consequence. We did do camera tests initially. And of course, when you're working with a DP, they will always choose 35. So I knew I was losing a battle there, because I'd be like, but look at this, you know, the Alexas can be done. And he's like, no. And I'm like, you're the only person that's going to notice this, you know, but he was right ultimately. But I'll tell you, there's something quite weird. Like, you're sitting talking to someone and you're, you know, if I'm doing an interview to camera, normally I can let it run. But when you're sitting opposite someone and you've got a little record button because you know you can only afford to hit this for 10 minutes, it does something to your ability to kind of work out what's going on in front of you a lot. You know, you keep it focused, you keep an eye on the prize, so to speak, a lot more. You're just more conscious of what you need, how this will feed into the story, what's gone before it, what, you know, where this could be tied in. And so you're just, bring it back to Zhivago, David Lean, editor, background. He talks about, like, you know, not leaving anything, you know, everything he goes out is very storyboarded because he knows, and he's directing as an editor would. And I think I'm a bit like that when I'm making, and which is odd territory for a documentary maker, because a lot of people just leave a lot to chance, obviously, and just want to be in the moment and observe, where I am sort of editing as I go all the time.
But I think that's why the film is distinctive, because it does feel precious. Like, every moment in it is of value.
Well, it was valuable, to be honest. It cost us a fortune every time we turned over. I mean, sorry, the poor ass cam, because I'm like, cut. And then I could hear the camera ticking. I was like, cut, cut. You have to run a little bit longer. Like, so we did a feedback at Norm on one of, you know, you send it back to your financiers, you know, obviously, and they get to see the film. And one of the notes came back, was like, oh, I think this is a weird cut. And I was like, yes, because we ran out of film just at that moment. So I was like, that is the final little tale. Anyway, they are the problems with 35. They're few and far between.
That's good. It's an Easter egg for the audience to look for when they see it.
Yeah.
Can you spot the tail?
Yes, exactly.
My thanks to Ken Wardrop.
whose latest documentary, So This Is Christmas, will have its North American premiere at Hot Docs next Tuesday, April 30th at 8:15 p.m. at the TIFF Lightbox. And it repeats Thursday, May 2nd at 4:45 p.m. at the Scotiabank 7. Thanks also to Kate Yorga. She knows what she did. You can find Ken on Instagram at Ken Wardrop, all one word, and you can find Dr. Zhivago in an excellent 45th anniversary Blu-ray from Warner Home Entertainment. I figure the 4K release will arrive next year in time for the film's 60th anniversary. It's also streaming on Tubi in the US and available to rent or buy on various VOD services across North America. You can find me on Blue Sky at Norm Wilner, and you can find this podcast there at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. The first year of the show is still available for just $20 at payhip.com/semcast. That's the first 52 episodes of Someone Else's Movie, 44 of which aren't currently available anywhere else. And check out my newsletter, Shiny Things, at shiny-things.ghost.io. I think you'll enjoy it. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review wherever you've been listening. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're doing that. Stay safe. Watch movies, wear a mask if you go out, get the new booster when you can. I'll see you next week.